Today's scripture is Deuteronomy 19:16-20. If a malicious witness comes forward to accuse someone of wrongdoing, then both parties to the dispute shall appear before the Lord, the judges who are in office. In those days, and the judges shall make a thorough inquiry. If the witness is a false witness, having testified falsely against another, then you shall do to the false witness just as the false witness had meant to you. Others, so ye shall purge the evil from your midst. The rest shall hear and be afraid in a crime such as this shall never again be committed among you. Matthew 5:33-37. Again, you have heard that it was said to those who of ancient times, you shall not swear falsely, but carry out the vows you have made to the Lord. But I say to you, do not swear at all, either by heaven, for it is the throne of God, or by the earth, for it is his footstool, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great King. And do not swear by your head, for you cannot make one hair white or black. Let your word be yes, yes, or no, no. Anything more than this comes from the evil one.
Thank you, Aiden. Perhaps you're familiar with the story The Fugitive, whether it is the 1993 film with Harrison Ford or the 1960s television show that inspired it. If you're not familiar, don't worry about it. The central idea is something that shows up time and time again in our media. It's the image of an innocent man, in this case, Dr. Richard Kimball, who gets accused of killing his wife and then is arrested. He manages to escape and then spends the rest of the storyline there trying to find who framed him. That storyline shows up, as I said, many times if you watch television shows or movies. Any serialized TV show inevitably has that episode where the central character gets framed. And the whole gist of the episode is trying to find out the person who framed the hero or heroine of the series. We think about this, and we think about the image of someone who's falsely accused. But to have someone falsely accused, you have to have a false witness. Someone who is spinning lies to convict someone else. It is a devious situation. And we always cheer for the character who helps uncover the plot, whether it's Perry Mason or Matlock or Jack McCoy from Law and Order, or one of the lawyers in a John Grisham novel. The person who can ferret out the false witness always seems to gather our sympathies. But are we so distant from the false witness? How could a person do such a terrible thing to shape lies to hurt someone else. Perhaps we've begun with the extreme example of that. Well, let's put that to the side for a moment and ask ourselves, what do we think about the world? Do we, when we watch stories about the latest televangelist who has been exposed for manipulating people to get money, or when another story hits the news about the corruption of a politician that we voted for, or we think about that car salesman who sold us our last car and we wonder, well, did we get a good deal or not? In all these kinds of situations, we are saying, well, this is the way the world is. And if we fundamentally ask ourselves, well, how do we live in that world? What do we think we should do? How are we going to survive in a world where other people are manipulating us? And do we ever step into that role of being a manipulator who potentially is seeking advancement at the expense of other people? And really, is that so distant? Isn't there a strain in American culture that praises the survivor, the intelligent person who can manipulate the situation? Think about another film. Perhaps you saw Catch Me If You Can. It was based on a true story about a man who impersonated lawyers, doctors, pilots, and then, of course, was involved in check fraud. Think about also, if you want a literary example, some of you may have read Huckleberry Finn. You know, Huckleberry Finn has that central character. He and Jim are on a raft floating down the Mississippi. They have a series of misadventures. But one of the ones that really stood out to me as a boy was his rescuing two men who are running from someone else. And that sort of gives you a clue from the beginning. Why are they running from someone? But they then introduce themselves to Huck. And one of them says, well, I'm an English duke. And his companion, not to be outdone, says, well, you know, I'm the long-lost heir to the King of France. And before the story is over, they have posed as missionaries, as Shakespearean actors, and as long-lost relatives to inherit the fortunes of someone who's recently deceased. We, I think, have a love-hate relationship with these kinds of characters. They're known as confidence men, as grifters, as con artists. Even the title suggests that there's something we admire about it. And yet, really? Should we? If we're ever the victim in these situations, we don't have admiration for them. And that is the world that Jesus speaks to today when we turn to the Sermon on the Mount. Once again, we are in that section where Jesus is explaining how his ministry is in continuity with the law and the prophets, how the New Testament relates to the old. He says that he's come not to abolish the law and the prophets, but to fulfill them. And we pause there, and the last series of sermons is focusing on that word fulfill. What does it mean to fulfill the law and the prophets? Jesus quotes several times from the law in this first chapter. He says, you've heard it was said, do not commit murder, but I say to you, do not let anger master you and enter into your heart and affect your relationships with other people. You've heard it was said, do not commit adultery, but I say to you, do not let lust into your heart and turn someone else into a sexual object. And then here he said, you've heard it was said, you should keep your oaths, and any oaths sworn to the Lord must be kept. But I say to you, don't make any oaths. Let your yes be yes, and your no be no. We look at that and it seems so simple. And yet we look back into the Old Testament. Jesus himself has been quoting from Exodus and Deuteronomy. And here, if we look back, we see, obviously, in the Ten Commandments, that heart of the Jewish law, do not bear false witness against your neighbor. Many people misunderstand this, and they think the Ten Commandments say, do not lie. But this is more specific. Do not bear false witness against your neighbor. Do not manipulate the situation with your words to hurt someone else, to falsely accuse someone else. And there are many different examples throughout Leviticus and Deuteronomy. Leviticus speaks about those times when you try to lie to cover up another sin. Deuteronomy, the passage Aidan read there, focuses on how someone who's a false witness is trying to push an enemy or someone else toward a penalty, towards a punishment. And what does Deuteronomy say there? That person, when caught, should get the punishment that they were trying to give to the other person. So if the false witness is trying to lead someone else toward paying $30,000, then when caught, the false witness must pay $30,000, etc., etc. And then Proverbs has a series of verses here emphasizing how God detests wicked speech. Six things the Lord hates, seven are detestable to Him: a proud eye, a false tongue, hands that shed innocent blood, a mind given to forging wicked schemes, feet that run swiftly to evil, a false witness telling a pack of lies. And so here we see throughout the Old Testament that sense of the wickedness that's involved in shaping your words to hurt someone else. And so Jesus Himself here is exposing that same tradition and that same problem. But here He makes things even simpler. In the Old Testament, we had the swearing of oaths. And certainly this is not something foreign to us. We think about the courtroom and what does the witness do before stepping into the box? Swear an oath to tell the truth and nothing but the truth, so help you God. Why do you have to say that before you step into the box? Think about our childhood. When you had a friend and the two of you figured out something, you had this nice secret between the two of you, and you wanted your friend to remain quiet, what sorts of things did you do to guarantee that your friend would remain quiet? Cross your heart, so help me God, or cross my heart, or I hope to die. I'm sorry, I'm blanking on the exact words. But those are the kinds of things that we typically wanted to do. But what was always the thing that we wanted to see? Why are your hands behind your back? What's this fingers crossed thing? As kids, we thought there were ways to get out of oaths. We could say the oaths, but there was some way to wiggle out of it. And then we as adults, what do? We bring in lawyers. And why do we bring in lawyers? So that they can look for loopholes, the ways you can manipulate your words once again to come out on top. To come out to be the one that was not the victim. And so here, Jesus is asking us to move to the simplicity of yes being yes, no being no, being trustworthy. Not being con artists, not pretending to be a duke or a king or a doctor or a lawyer when we don't have those credentials. And yet we think about the very situation that Jesus Himself steps into. Jesus speaking into this world of lies. Jesus carrying out His ministry. And then when we get to those crucial events in Jerusalem at the very end, we of course think about the crucifixion. But how did we get to the crucifixion? False witnesses. two false witnesses come forward to accuse Jesus. Jesus himself submits himself to our lies on the cross. And that is a significant event. Submission to these false witnesses. And yet we ourselves today, as we try to expose our own lies, our own attempts to try to manipulate our words and situations to our advantage, we ask ourselves, are we capable of discerning the difference between falsehoods and the truth? We know famously or infamously Pilate said, "What is truth?" when he was putting Jesus on trial. And we ourselves today wonder, can we answer that question? Do we know what the truth is? Ethicists say that one of the crucial things in a moral life is the ability to confront self-deception. You can't have a moral life unless you can admit your own tendency to lie to yourself. Because if you look at some of the exaggerated examples that always come to the front in an ethics classroom, Nazis almost always come to the front, and they say, well, how could the Nazis have done what they did? They told themselves that they were moral and upright people. But we ask ourselves on a more simplistic basis, can we tell the difference? We know the word rationalization. We look for ways to explain away why we are doing. And these are lies that we tell ourselves. And the only way we as Christians confess that we can come to grips with this self-deception and this tendency to lie or to offer false witness is to come to Jesus, to come to Christ, to bow before him, to confess those times when we have manipulated others, and to confess those times when we do rationalize, when we do look for excuses to explain why we have done what we've done, and to constantly say, well, aren't we good people? And we ask ourselves today, what does it mean to be people who speak the truth? As we've said, it begins at the cross. It begins bowing before Jesus' sacrifice and acknowledging that we are complicit in that, that we also have been false witnesses, and that we also contributed to Jesus' crucifixion. And it is only when we give up the false image that we are good people and instead come to the realization that we are sinners in need of salvation, that we then can start to learn to speak the truth in love. This is not to say that we are to say everything in every situation, because speech has a context. It does mean that we are guided by love, but it does not mean that we are to expose everything. So if a friend comes up to us and she's wearing a purple dress and she says, "Do you like my dress?" And you say, "I hate purple." It's not that situation. Or if we have another situation where a teacher asks, "Why were you late?" And then the student says, "Well, it's because my dad was drinking last night and he stayed too late and he couldn't get us home, he couldn't get us to school in time." There are proper places for our speech. And then, of course, those images, once again, if the Nazis were knocking on the door and you had a Jewish person hiding in your basement and they said, "Well, where is that person?" I do not believe that as a follower of Christ you are obligated to say the truth in that situation. And so there are situations when we must look for ways to encourage others with our speech, to move away from the tendency to manipulate and to try to look for ways to benefit ourselves at the expense of others. And if we are followers of Christ, we come to Jesus' words in the Gospel of John, John chapter 8, verses 31 and 32. Turning to the Jews who had believed him, Jesus said, "If you stand by my teaching, you are truly my disciples. You will know the truth, and the truth will set you free." In a world of lies, the truth will set us free. A number of people will look at us and wonder how we could be so naive. But it is in holding to the truth that we will set ourselves aside as the followers of Jesus. This morning we come to a time of invitation and commitment. Hymn number 581, "'Tis So Sweet to Trust in Jesus." If you've not made that commitment, if you've not put your trust in Jesus, now is the time for you to do so. And this congregation will pray for you and encourage you as you seek to be a disciple of Christ. Now is also a time of recommitment if you would come forward and pray and ask for the Lord's guidance in helping to tell the truth in the world of lies. Let's stand together and sing.